This particular sutta is very good and is very interesting. So I hope you get a lot out of it. Thus have I heard on one occasion a Venerable Ananda was living in a town near Vesali. Now on that occasion a householder, Dhammasama, had arrived from Pataliputta for some business or other. Then when a certain monk in Kukuputta's park, after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and asked him, "Where does the Venerable Ananda live now, Venerable Sir? I wish to see a Venerable Ananda." "The Venerable Ananda is living near Vesali, householder." When the householder Dhammasama had completed his business in Pataliputta, he went to the Venerable Ananda, after paying homage to him, sat down at one side and asked him, "Venerable Ananda, has any one thing been proclaimed by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully awakened, wherein if a monk abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, his unliberated mind comes to be liberated, and his undestroyed taints come to be destroyed, and he attains the supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before? There is, householder, indeed one such thing proclaimed by the Blessed One." "What is that one thing, Venerable Ananda?" "Here, householder, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a monk enters upon and abides in the first jhana." Now, one of the things that's happened in America in particular is that the word jhana has been misinterpreted, and people are told to not practice jhana. The word jhana in the suttas is mentioned about 10,000 times. So it seems to me that that isn't the correct kind of thinking. Oh, you shouldn't practice jhana. The Buddha didn't teach jhana. Well, yes, he did. He taught mostly jhana. But the interpretation of jhana by most people is one-pointed concentration or absorption concentration, which is what the Buddha did not teach. It gets confusing because there's more than one kind of jhana that's being taught. The kind of jhana that I teach is different from the kind of jhana that everybody else thinks about. I'm hearing a backlash on this. It's kind of a back hum. Yeah, just a bit. Sorry.
Say something?
Okay.
It's
not quite loud enough. Now?
Let's try that.
Is that loud enough?
Yeah, it is.
Yes.
Okay.
It's kind of cutting in and out.
Mm-hmm. So cut it out. The kind of jhana I teach is what the Buddha taught, and it's by following the directions in the suttas. that you attain this kind of jhana. Now, the kind of jhana that has been practiced before the Buddha came around and by the Brahmins, who were the main religious group in India during the time of the Buddha, is one-pointed concentration. It came from the Vedas. Now, what's all of this mean? One-pointed concentration is this. Your mind is on your object of meditation. It gets distracted. Immediately, you let go of that distraction and come back to your object of meditation. When you do this, what happens with your mind is the force of the concentration that you eventually develop stops hindrances from arising, and your mind becomes absorbed in an object of meditation. And there's a lot of danger in this kind of meditation. I've run across people that have had to be put in mental institutes because they were doing wrong kind of concentration. And it just addled their mind so much that they weren't reliable anymore. What I teach, we call it TWIM, Tranquil Wisdom Insight Meditation. Now, this kind of jhana, your mind is on your object of meditation, your mind gets distracted. You let go of the distraction and relax the tightness in your head, in your mind, caused by that distraction. When you let go of that tightness, you're letting go of craving. What's the second noble truth? The cause of craving, or the cause of suffering is craving. Now, almost all people that are practicing different forms of meditation are not recognizing this tension and tightness. So they're practicing a kind of meditation that will not lead to personality development, will not lead to the overcoming of suffering. So there is a distinct difference between what the Buddha was teaching in the suttas and what most people are teaching as the Buddhist meditation. And to be quite honest, I listen to other teachers give Dhamma talks and I get bored with their talks because they use a lot of words but they don't really say anything. They're not really teaching you anything. And that's not the Buddha's style. The Buddha's style was so that your understanding can be so good that you can change things for yourself. And it comes from that extra step of relaxing. It tranquilizes your mind. What happens when you relax and you let go of that tension and tightness? Right after that, you'll notice that your mind is very clear. Your mind is very bright. Your mind is pure. Why is it pure? Because you've let go of craving. And that's the cause of suffering. So your mind becomes pure when you let go of that craving. There's a lot of different kinds of thing when you're practicing meditation in this way that occur during your sitting. For one thing, the force of the concentration when you're doing this kind of sitting does not suppress anything. It doesn't stop things from happening. It doesn't push down. A lot of people, when they're teaching about meditation, they say, oh, the hindrances. You have to push them down. You have to push them away. You have to stop them from becoming a distraction. I have a friend that's been teaching meditation for many, many, many years. And if you listen to him get in front of a large group of people, you can still hear a little bit of fear in his voice. He has had trouble with fear since before he started teaching. And he even talks about, yeah, I still have fear. It doesn't bother me so much anymore. But it's still there. Now, is that purifying your mind? That's the real question. If you're not able to let go of the cause of suffering, then the suffering is not going to go away. If you can't recognize that suffering and the cause of it, there's no sense in doing the meditation as far as I can see. I'm into very much end results. Now, there's a lot of meditations that are very helpful in some ways. But what's the end result? The end result that I'm looking for is the cessation of suffering. And the Buddha taught that there's a right way to practice meditation and a wrong way. And the wrong way of practicing is emphasizing suffering. The right way is learning how suffering ceases, how it stops. So what I'm going to be doing during this retreat is showing you a lot of different things that the Buddha said about how to let go of suffering. And when you follow the directions, you don't add anything, you don't subtract anything, you don't change anything. When you follow the directions exactly, precisely, you will see a major difference in yourself. And it's nothing that I'm doing that causes that to happen. What I'm doing is just telling you what the Buddha said. And it is immediately effective. One of the things when he talks about the good qualities of the Dhamma, the second quality is called akaliko in Pali. Akaliko means immediately effective. How many people do you know have been meditating for years and they hit a wall and they just can't go any deeper, they can't go any further, and they get tired of it and they quit meditating? That doesn't happen with this meditation. Why? Because it's immediately effective. Every time there's a distraction, it pulls your attention away from your object of meditation. You use the 6 R's on it, you recognize it, you release the distraction by not keeping your attention on it. Don't make a big deal of any kind of distraction. Relax, smile, come back to your object of meditation. Stay with your object of meditation for as long as you can. Now, how is this immediately effective? You've let go of a hindrance. You've let go of the craving. You've developed smiling and having an uplifted mind, a light mind, and you're bringing that light mind back to your object of meditation. And what happens when you do that enough is the hindrance goes away. And when the hindrance goes away, you feel relief. Now, why do hindrances keep coming up? Because you've done things in the past. It might be a past lifetime. It might be in this lifetime. Who knows? It doesn't matter what the cause is. The reason a hindrance keeps coming up is because you did something in the past that made you feel guilty. And that guilty feeling makes you take it personally. This is me, this is mine. I did that. I shouldn't have done it, but I did it. Now I'm feeling guilty because of it. So every time you use the six R's, you're letting go of that wrong opinion of a personal self being you. This is me. This is mine. This is who I am. So every time you let go of that craving, you're letting go of that wrong belief in a personal self. And that's immediately effective. You went from taking it personally to seeing that it's not personal. It's just a thought. It's just a feeling. So there's a lot of relief when you let go of that. Right after that relief, you feel very strong joy. Now the kind of, there's five different kinds of joy. The first kind of joy, well, the first three kinds of joy can be experienced at anybody at any time. The first kind of joy is like goosebumps. Something really nice happens and you get some goosebumps. Oh, that's a good feeling. Yeah, nice. The next kind of joy is like a flash of lightning. It's very strong, but it's only there for a short period of time. Now, what happens after every kind of joy that arises is right after that, you feel a sense of tranquility. As it gets stronger, the tranquility lasts longer. You feel more peaceful, more calm, more balanced in your mind for a period of time. The next kind of joy is like standing in the ocean and just having a wave of joy come over you. And then another wave comes over you. And you might be able to sit for a few minutes. After that joy fades away, where your mind is really calm and it's quiet and it's very, very nice. Now, the last two kinds of joy only arise through mental development. The next kind of joy is called uplifting joy. This is what you experience when you get into a jhana, this kind of joy. You feel very light in your body and light in your mind. And you feel, yeah, this is good. This is really a nice, happy feeling. I like that. And then that joy will fade away. Now, you have to understand every feeling that arises is just a feeling. It's not my feeling. Sometimes people try to hold on to a happy feeling because they've had so much suffering in their life. You don't hold on to it. You just let it be there as long as it's going to be. you feel light in your body, light in your mind, and you start going, this is the reason that I really started meditating. This is good. I like that. But you let it be there. When that feeling fades away, you feel very strong tranquility. And you feel more comfortable in your mind and in your body than you've ever felt before. Just at ease. And that'll last for a period of time. Your mind becomes very unified. Now, I just described to you the first jhana. Now, the last kind of joy that arises is the awakening factor of joy. It's called all-pervading joy. It doesn't have the excitement in it of the other kinds of joy you've experienced. This kind of joy is a real happy feeling. And your mind is very alert. When this kind of joy fades away, the tranquility and the balance of mind is very strong. Excuse me. Now, getting back to the one-pointed concentration, a lot of people, especially in this country, will tell you that if you get into jhana, you cannot experience nibbana. Nibbana means no more fire. What's the cause of fire arising in your mind? Craving. So Nibbana is basically saying no more craving for a period of time. So, when you are practicing one-pointed concentration, not using the relaxed step, your mind can go very deep in concentration. But the force of the concentration stops things from arising. And that's why you can't attain Nibbana by doing that kind of meditation. Now, there's a lot of people that are practicing, you do the jhana. Then when you get out of the jhana, you switch your meditation over to straight vipassana, and then you can attain nibbana. Well, I've heard about that for the last 35 years, and I haven't seen one person that's been successful yet. So I have my doubts as to whether that really works. But there's a lot of attachments. People think they're doing the right thing, saying the right thing. One of the phenomena that's starting to happen now, and it really does make me happy, is a lot of people are starting to go back to the suttas and see what the Buddha said instead of listen to what somebody else said the Buddha said. Now, there's a lot of people that do teach meditation, and they want to teach from the heart, which is all good and well, but I want to know what the Buddha said about it. I don't want to know what somebody comes up with, some ideas. I'm very traditional. And I understand that that's kind of almost a dirty word. But I am the most successful meditation teacher that I know. And that's not bragging on my part. That is just stating a fact. 50% of the people that are doing retreats with me in Asia are successful. They are experiencing nibbana to one degree or another, and they're starting to be more and more happy all the time. And that's the whole point. Change your perspective. Let go of your old ways of thinking. And have a lot of loving acceptance of the present. Develop your equanimity so that your mind has more and more balance in it all the time. And the things that used to get you upset, it's not even worth mentioning anymore. So what? Your mind becomes much more at ease. And you become much more skillful at solving problems. Now, this is the advantages of doing this kind of meditation. And you are your own teacher. You're teaching yourself. I'm not the teacher. You see me reading the sutta. The Buddha's a teacher. I'm a guide. My job is to keep you on the path, keep you going in the straight way so you can have advantage for doing this meditation. And you can really benefit a lot. And nothing makes me happier than to see people benefit from this meditation. Believe me. Now, sometimes when you start to go deeper into your meditation, there's different things that happen. When you come for the interviews, that's what I'm going to be questioning about. I don't care about the story of how you got there. I have very specific things that I need to know. I had one person after the retreat, they said that Bhante kept on interfering with what I was trying to tell him. And what he was trying to tell me was a story, and I don't have time for stories. I mean, I see everybody every day. That's a lot of hours of interviews. Plus, I give a Dhamma talk in the evening. I'm busy. I haven't got time for a lot of stories. Although I might give you a few. Well, I have enough time to show you how to let it go, but you got to do it. The thing with hindrances is they're hindrances because they stop you from staying on your object of meditation. And you have to learn that the hindrances are not your enemy to fight with. Now, last night she was talking about pain. And she was talking about taking that pain personally and wanting to get up and run away from it. And that doesn't make it go away. That just postpones it a little bit. We have to learn to develop patience. My teacher, Usilananda, a great monk, absolutely brilliant, had the habit of telling me a lot, patience leads to nibbana. And I'm patient, as long as I get what I want when I want it. So you have to be patient and not just try to run away from things when they first start to come up. Now, in Malaysia, there was 11 different countries that people from 11 different countries came to that retreat. So that was a real interesting time for me to have that many different ways of describing how things work for them. And I had to really stress very much patience. When hindrances arise, the six R's are not there to stop them from causing pain. The six R's are there to let go of craving. That's it. The pain will go away by itself when you lose the attachments. What is an attachment? It's craving. It's taking something personally. It's making a big deal out of something in your mind and trying to control. There is no control. There's only observation and allowing it to burn out by itself. So the more you're able to stay on your object of meditation, not with an iron fist, but just letting your mind stay with your object of meditation without trying to force it, the more you do that and use the six R's when your mind gets distracted, the faster your progress becomes. Now, at the first part of your retreat, you might be able to sit for half an hour, 45 minutes, and your mind starts to have a little bit of joy arise. That's good, but don't be attached to it. There's a lot more that's a lot better. And you'll see that for yourself. I don't want you to believe anything that I say. Now, how many meditation teachers have you heard say that? Check it out. See if it is, if it's, whether it's right or not. So the more you are teaching yourself not to fight with hindrances, not to try to control them, to allow them to be, you start seeing that when these hindrances arise, they are teaching you where your attachment is and how to let go of that attachment by using the six R's. Your mind will naturally start to become more uplifted and happy as you stop trying to make my mind be the way I want it to be when I want it that way. There's nothing about making your mind be anything. There's only remembering to observe how mind's attention moves from one thing to another. It's important to see this because when you're able to see how mind's attention moves, you start to see for yourself and teach yourself, this is part of an impersonal process. I didn't ask for this stuff to happen. I didn't want it to come up. I can't make it go away. All I can do is observe how this process works. And as you continually teach yourself about how this process works, you naturally start to become more happy. You become lighter with your perspective of things. You become more accepting of things. Instead of somebody coming up and being extremely rude to you and you getting mad at them, you just let it go. Not that important to get upset about. Yeah, but that no good so-and-so said or did this, and I really hate that. So, how much pain do you cause yourself? Because I don't like it. I am taking it personally. And that is a false belief. This meditation will show you how to let go of that more and more. So you develop more and more balance with everything, every part of aspect of your life. More accepting. Don't resist or push. Soften your mind and smile. Doesn't matter how much pain comes up or what the reason of the pain is. The reason for the pain, we don't care about the reasons. Sometimes we find out what the reason is, sometimes we don't. It doesn't matter. It's how the process works. That's the thing that's important. And you're going to hear me talk more and more about dependent origination. And this is the process. This is how everything arises. As you get more and more educated with how this process works, you start to have more and more balance in your mind. And you start seeing for yourself, you make a big deal out of anything, you're going to cause yourself suffering. And until you stop making a big deal out of it and taking it personally, you're going to continue suffering. And you can't blame anybody else for your pain. Oh, but he said this and I don't like that. Oops. Who doesn't like it? I don't. Who wants it to be different than it is? I wish they hadn't said that. So? Who doesn't like that? Who wants it to be different? Who's causing themselves more and more pain because you're making a big deal out of it and taking it personally? Now, the thing with the Buddha's path that is very important, and it's not something that is liked very much in this country, and it's called morality. But most people in this country don't even understand what morality really means. It means these five precepts that you take for your daily life, you keep them. And your mind will naturally become calm. Now, the first precept, don't harm or kill living beings on purpose. Second precept, don't take anything that's not given. Don't steal anything. How do you feel when somebody steals something of yours? The third precept, don't do any wrong sexual activity. What is wrong sexual activity? Wrong sexual activity is sexual activity with another person's mate or with someone that is your mate that has other relationships going. Sexual activity with somebody that's too young. Sexual activity that causes any other person to have dislike come up in their mind. So keeping sexual activity doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be married to have sexual activity, but it means that you don't cause anybody else upset because you're having that relationship. The next precept is the one that's probably the hardest. Don't tell any lies. A white lie is a lie. Don't knowingly say things that are false. Don't curse. Look at your mind if you start cursing. What's happening in your mind? A lot of hatred. When I came back to Asia, which is 15 years ago now, I was absolutely shocked to see television, the language that they were using on television. Cursing is becoming okay. The radio, cursing. I was absolutely shocked by that. What is that saying? That's saying that people, they're giving their dislike and dissatisfaction to everybody else around them in an offensive way. And don't do that. That makes other people upset. And your mind is upset. Your mind has hatred in it when you're getting caught up in cursing. Don't try to split groups, one group from another, by saying, well, this group over here, they're saying this about you. And you come to this group and you say, well, they're saying this about you. Doesn't matter. Let it go. And don't gossip. What is gossip? It's making up stories that aren't true. It's trying to cause problems for other people. So these four different kinds of speech are very important to keep. Now the fifth precept, don't take drugs and alcohol that dull the mind. I have some students that they thought that that wasn't the right thing. So they had a glass of wine. And then they saw, now these are people that were pretty advanced in meditation, but they drank a glass of wine and it affected their meditation for 3 or 4 days afterwards. Their mind got dull. And you say, well, it's only one beer. It's only this little bit of wine. But it has a negative effect on your mind. And if you're serious about meditation, don't do it. Yeah, but I need to relax. Well, go meditate if you need to relax. Go have fun. Go play with some kids if you need to relax. Anytime you break one of the precepts, it causes hindrances to arise. Oh, I've had students for years that they would keep the precepts while they were on retreat. When they got off, they just went back to the way they did things before. And then they'd come back for another retreat and say, you know, this retreat, it's really hard. Well, yeah. Why? Because you break precepts. You have that guilty mind. You know, your mind knows when you break a precept. And your mind says, I shouldn't have done that. And then you come for a retreat and you sit in meditation and you have these hindrances coming up. And you have to go through that to purify your mind. So, after 8 or 9 days on a retreat, your mind finally has purified itself enough, it starts to go deeper, and then you're done with the retreat. So, keep your precepts without breaking them. And of course, there's always these clowns that say, okay, I'm going to keep all the precepts. How long do I have to do that? Well, my answer is, for another 100 years at least, and we'll go up from there. It's important to keep these precepts. There's no God in heaven that's going to throw down a thunderbolt at you because you broke a precept, but you know you've done it yourself. You've taken something that wasn't given. And then you can justify it all you want, but that doesn't mean that you haven't broken the precept. One of the things that happens when people come to the center is there's a lot of making up reasons why things are happening the way they're happening, and they look to put blame on anybody else. They're not taking responsibility for themselves. And that turns into a problem for them because they don't want to take responsibility for their breaking their own precepts. They want to blame somebody else because of this problem. And progress is very slow because of it. Now, the reason that I have you doing the precepts every morning is not some kind of rite and ritual. It's a reminder to keep the precepts. And if you say something that's not true, you've broken the precept, it's going to affect your meditation negatively all day until you take the precepts the next morning. So, when you realize that you broke a precept, right then, stop what you're doing. Forgive yourself for making a mistake. Make a determination that I'm not going to do that again. And take the precepts again. That way you can purify your own mind. It's important to do that. As I was telling you this morning, there was a monk that when he first came to the meditation center, he was doing great. He was sitting 3 hours. And that's when I could barely sit for two. And by the end of his retreat, because he broke one precept that he felt guilty for it, he couldn't sit more than 15 minutes. Now why do you think that is? Because he took it personally. He decided, I know this is something that I should follow, but I'm not going to do it. And as a result, it affected the meditation in a negative way. Can't blame me for that. It's not my fault. I don't have anything to do with your keeping your precepts. All I can do is recommend that it's a good thing and to do it all the time, not just while you're on retreat. If you keep your precepts for a year without breaking them and you come for a retreat, your meditation is going to fly. Your meditation is going to go very deep very quickly. Why? Because you've kept your precepts. And that leads to strong tranquility and equanimity. So the hindrances, when they come up, they are your teacher, and you're teaching yourself about how to let go of these hindrances. You're teaching yourself about the cause of the hindrances by keeping precepts. It's real important to be careful about what you say. Okay? It doesn't mean you can't joke. You can. But everybody knows that you're just making a joke. You're not breaking a precept. There's a story in one of the commentaries about a monk went out on alms round and he came back and he had a lot of food in his bowl. And one of the monks was just going out on alms round. He said, how's the alms round today? And he said, oh, the streets are flowing with food. Now, that's not a true statement, right? But it's a way of describing it. You're not trying to fool other people. You're not trying to get them to believe something that you know is untrue. Okay. Okay. Here, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a person enters upon and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by thinking and examining thought, with joy and happiness born of seclusion. That is what the first jhana is like. You'll be able to stay on your object to meditation for a period of time without any distractions. And you'll be able to see when your mind starts to move away and you'll catch it more quickly and come back. Every time your mind moves away from your object of meditation, you're not in that jhana at that time. He considers this and understands it thus. The first jhana is conditioned and you're directing your mind. It's volitionally produced. You're directing your mind to stay with one of the objects of meditation, whatever that happens to be. But whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to change, subject to cessation. If he's steady in that, he attains the destruction of the taints. But if he does not attain the destruction of the taints, because of that desire for the Dhamma, that delight in the Dhamma, then with the destruction of the five lower fetters, he becomes one due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes. And there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. Now, what are we talking about here? If you attain even the first jhana with the tranquil wisdom meditation, while you're in that jhana, your mind can all of a sudden go very deep and you can become an arahat just by being in the first jhana. Doesn't happen very often, I grant it. But I have had students that have been in the jhanas, not all the way up to the highest jhanas, and attained nibbana. There was a nun that came and she started practicing with me. She was a Mahayana nun. And most Mahayana teachers are very, very severe. They don't like people that smile. They don't like people that are happy for the most part. And that's just a general thing that I'm saying. It's not specific. Everyone is like that. But because that's not, no, nobody is always going to be how you describe. But when she first came, she was so sour-faced, very serious, had these deep lines in her forehead. And I kept telling her she had to smile. And by the third day of the retreat, she actually heard what I said, and she started smiling, and she said, "Does this mean I can have fun?" And I said, "Yeah." And the next day, she went into the breakfast, started eating, staying with the loving kindness and her spiritual friend, and got into the first jhana because of that. And after that, she was Miss Smiley. She was smiling all the time and being happy all the time. And the deep lines in her face, the deep frown lines, were trying too hard. They disappeared. And it was great. It was really good fun to see somebody get it. So please smile. Please smile all the time. Keep your mind light. Anytime you get serious, guess who has an attachment? Guess who's taking it personally? Guess who's causing themselves pain? It's okay to smile. It's okay to laugh, and it is okay to have fun. You don't hear meditation teachers say that very often. I think I'm about the only one I know of that says it. Well, meditation is supposed to be serious. Well, then be seriously happy. How's that? Keep your mind light. Whenever you get serious about anything, I am there. I want to control. I want it to be the way I want it to be. And that's a cause of suffering. So, this is an all-the-time practice. It's not just sitting and walking practice. And that's hard to get across, because an awful lot of people, when the Chinese and Japanese started coming over to this country in the 1800s, their main focus in meditation was sitting. And that's why meditation is called sitting. Because they just drummed it into everybody that you have to sit. And that's when you're doing your meditation. But to be able to carry your meditation with you all the time, the thing with the six R's that's very important is to understand that's a way you can let go of your suffering in your daily activities. And the more you smile with your daily activities, the better your mindfulness becomes. you're able to see what your mind is doing in the present. And when your mind starts to get serious and starts to get pulled down with all of these problems, well, that's the time that you use your six R's. And smile into that. Keep your mind light. Don't take it heavily. I've got to worry about this. Well, no, you don't. It's your choice to worry about it, whether you're going to do it or not. But, oh, this is so bad. How can I handle this? How can I take care of that? Well, you can do it with a serious mind that resists and wants to control, doesn't like the situation, gets angry pretty easy, or not. You can be very accepting of whatever arises. It doesn't matter what the feeling is like, whether it is a mental feeling or a physical feeling. The thing is that when you take it personally, it makes your mind have more and more craving in it and more desire to control and make it be the way you want it to be. And honestly, it doesn't work. It really doesn't. The more you can allow and just say, okay, you're there, so what? It's all right. It doesn't mean you don't work. If you have joints that need to be straightened out, that doesn't mean you don't straighten them out. It means you don't have resistance to straightening them out. And you don't get into the dislike of the sensation for it being there. Did you ask a sensation to come up? You're sitting in meditation and all of a sudden you have a pain in your knee. Did you say, you know, I haven't had any pain in my knee for a while. I might as well have some now. No, you don't have any control over that sort of thing. What you do have control over is what you do with that when it arises. Use the six R's not as some kind of stick to beat things away, to stop them from happening. That's not what six R's are about. The six R's are very specifically, right effort is very specifically used to let go of craving, the cause of the suffering. And the six R's and right effort are the same thing, just a different way of describing it. It's just like the five aggregates and four foundations of mindfulness are different ways of saying the same thing. The Buddha was real big on the five aggregates. When he would teach monks, he would teach them about the five aggregates because they understood that. Later on, he changed over to doing the foundations of mindfulness. That was a later kind of teaching. But it was still the same thing. The five aggregates, you have body, you have feeling, you have perception. Now, perception and feeling are conjoined, always. When a feeling comes up, you know whether it's a pleasant feeling or a painful feeling. Perception is a part of the mind that tells you that. Okay? You have sankharas. You have thoughts. You have, I generally, for beginners, I talk about thoughts more than sankharas. And you have consciousness. The four foundations of mindfulness, you have body, same as with the five aggregates. You have feeling, same as with the five aggregates. You have consciousness, same with the five aggregates. You have dhammas, same with the five aggregates. Now, isn't that amazing? Well, the four foundations of mindfulness, they're so important to people that are practicing Vipassana. But I've found over the years that they just talk about generally what the four foundations of mindfulness are. They don't talk specifically about what they are. And the four foundations of mindfulness in the sutta is talking about jhana practice. But they've taken that understanding away and say, oh, that's just Vipassana. But it is describing all kinds of things about jhana practice. The way the Buddha taught jhana was that the four foundations or the five aggregates, whichever way you want to say it, is in each jhana. While you're actually in the jhana, you're practicing the four foundations of mindfulness. And there's more than one sutta that agrees with that. So there's a lot of things that are kind of misunderstood. I don't believe they're purposefully misunderstanding, but there is a misunderstanding with the different ways of doing the practice. And I am very much enthusiastic about practicing what the Buddha is talking about. And specifically following what the Buddha was talking about. And it is great fun for me to watch people start to understand. It's really nice. Doesn't take that long. From now until the end of the retreat, outside of being your guide, I am the educator. And you'll be a lot smarter about Buddhism by the end of the retreat, because you'll have some of the direct experiences. You'll have some of the direct knowledge for yourself. And again, you're your own teacher. I can present ideas that the Buddha was talking about. You decide whether you want to try it or not. Generally speaking, when you follow what the Buddha says, it works. It works very well. And it is immediately effective. I mean, when you have a hindrance arise and you let it be there and you relax, that hindrance is not there anymore. That's immediate. Now, when I'm talking about the six R's, I'm talking about words that you need to do, not say over and over again. Okay? This is a list of words to do. Recognize, as soon as you notice you're not on your object of meditation, you've already recognized it. You don't have to tell yourself, I need to recognize this. And you let it be and relax and smile and come back to your object of meditation and stay there. It's a flow. Don't put any philosophy with it. This is a method. And it works very well. And it works all the time. Your job is to remember to do it. So, with each of the jhanas that you'll go through, there's going to be a little different kind of experience that you're going to have. And you can have the experience of attaining Nibbana while you're in each one of these jhanas. Like I said, I have had students that have attained Nibbana while they're using the six R's. The thing with the jhana that is not very well understood, because it's taken from the Veda text, is people think the only time you can experience jhana is while you're sitting. Now, when you're walking, can you have joy? Can you have a peaceful, calm mind? Can you have a mind that's very collected and very at ease? Oh, that means you can be walking and being in the jhana? It doesn't matter what you're doing. What matters is how you're using your mindfulness. Keep your mind smiling. That improves your mindfulness so much it's unbelievable. And I can tell when you come in for the interview whether you're really smiling enough or not. And I might tell you, you got to smile more. Why? Because your mind's too heavy. As soon as you walk in, it's like somebody is bringing some lead on top of their head and pushing it down. Have fun with this retreat. And I give you all permission to have fun. How's that? Keep smiling as much as you can. Okay, so we didn't get very far on this sutta, but we will in the next one. Do you have any questions? Are we going to have smart people or dumb people? Yeah.
When you can tell that you've recognized something, but it isn't quite clear what it was you recognized.
It doesn't matter. Content doesn't matter. That's where people get a lot of confusion, because they want to follow it and see what it is. And that's distraction. Okay, I've had some students that they've been real close to getting to Nibbana, but they kept on having a memory of a past lifetime. And okay, let's go see this for a little while. No, the content of that doesn't matter. What matters is that you recognize that your mind is distracted. Let it be there by itself. Relax, smile, come back. You can get insights into what comes up. But the insights are always about the process of how it came up. And you might see, well, the reason this came up was because of that memory or whatever, but you don't follow that. That's for psychology. That's not for the Buddha's path. The Buddha's path is about how did this come up? And it always comes up in exactly the same way. And that's one of the things in Asia, they really don't like the idea when I tell them that there's no difference between the American mind and the Asian mind. They don't like that idea at all. But it's that you're a human being. All human beings' mind works in the same way. Exactly. And there's fascination with why something arises and follow it to the end and see if there's any resolution by it. But that's taking it personally. And we want to let go of that idea. Now, there's some weird things that happen when you start letting go and seeing the impersonal nature of everything. Your mind can have a lot of fear arise. And it starts throwing a temper tantrum. Just like a little kid. You're ignoring me. I've been in control how many lifetimes, and now you're not paying attention to me anymore. You're telling me that all the things I've done in the past isn't really me. It's a false belief. And your mind will throw up a lot of fear. And how do you get over that fear? You laugh at how crazy your mind can get. Everybody is crazy. It's okay to be crazy. Because we all are. We've been taking things personally for how many lifetimes? How much pain have we caused ourselves by taking it personally? By getting involved with the story and trying to solve problems. There's so much benefit gained by keeping your precepts without breaking them. By smiling more. By seeing things that are impersonal processes that we take as us. How much pain do we cause ourselves? And then you start letting go of that. And everything changes. Yeah.
I have a question about breaking precepts. In terms of looking at the scale of what the precept maintains. For instance, the one about not killing things. There's a part of me that if I see an insect, doesn't observe the same degree of respect as if it's a dog or a cat. And the issue is there a scale of evil which is
all yeah, but all beings want to live. They don't want to die. In order to kill, there has to be dislike.
Oh, I see. So that inevitably, even if it's unconscious, that there is a negative desire there, a negative take on it on an emotional level.
Right.
And then the other question I had was, if one wants to, you know, so I want to stop my behavior towards insects, because sometimes I don't always rescue them. And so as the issue of insect rescue comes in.
Well, we practice insect rescue a lot. We have some little devices that will just go around the insect and close in on it, then we take it outside, open it up, and let it go out. We do that with wasps, we do that with ladybugs, we do that with all kinds of things that like to come in. Now, one of the things, we have a lot of wasps where we live, a lot. And I got into the habit of catching them on the window, taking them in, letting them go out. But as I'm letting them go out, I tell them to tell all their friends I let them go free. Which sounds kind of weird, except I never get stung. It does work.
So then the final part of my trilogy, leading questions, is what counts as a valid actual switch over in terms of not getting the negative effects from past precept breaking with respect to precepts?
Yeah.
Asia has a... It has to do with your intention.
Mm-hmm.
When you stop intending to kill, then you're expanding the life cycle of other beings. If you just go out and start killing them, you're shortening that life cycle. You're shortening your own life cycle. Now, in Asia, they have, I mean, it's ant heaven in Asia. And they are really troublesome. And they bite, and the smaller the ant is, the bigger the bite is. So the Chinese have developed this chalk that you put around you. You just draw a circle around you, and the ants won't cross that line. There's a way of preventing them from bothering you. Now, mosquitoes are troublesome. So you sleep under a mosquito net. You don't have to kill them. Sometimes there is not the intention to kill, but something bites you and you go like that to see what it was and you accidentally kill them. Your intention was not to kill. Now, there's a story about this one monk that was blind, and he had a string between poles, and he was walking back and forth holding on to the string, and he was stepping on ants. And monks saw that, and they went to the Buddha to tattletale a little bit and say, he's killing these ants. And the Buddha said, his intention is not to kill. He's not doing it on purpose. He has no mental hold on any of that. So there's no wrongdoing.
So it's really set by the quality of the intention as part of the situation.
Well, if you kill anything on purpose, you don't have a wholesome mind. Let's just put it that way. Okay. And we can get into a long discussion about that, but I'm not gonna. Yeah.
Okay. I think this, at the end of last retreat, and certainly kind of storming right into this one, I'm starting to realize that every time mind comes up with discursive thought, it's always one subject, and that's me or I or something like that.
How about that?
This is really annoying.
Don't make it a big deal. Just 6 hours and continue on.
I mean, it's just relentless.
Oh, yeah. Craving is not particularly strong. It is particularly persistent. I mean, you can just barely have enough time to do the 6 hours and come back to your object before all of a sudden you're pulled away again. Just play it as it's a game. Don't make a big deal out of it.
Okay. Because it can be kind of absurd. Okay.
Well, and if you try too hard, one of the things that they started doing in Asia this time was that every thought that came up, they were 6R-ing as soon as they came, and they just had more and more and more thoughts, and they'd come to me and talk to me about being tired. It is tiring to 6R every little thing that comes up. You don't need to 6R every little thing that comes up. If it doesn't pull your attention away from your object of meditation and these thoughts come up, ignore them. If it pulls your attention away, now you use the 6 R's.
Yes, I've been in a local meditation group with some friends of mine, and it was really bizarre because they actually read both Doug's book and some of your writings too. And they still hadn't taken that in. So they were getting bent out of shape every time anything came up, which of course is really problematic.
Yeah. They're trying too hard. They have to back off on that. And what you have to tell them to do is they need to smile more. It's really true. Some people will come in and they'll be complaining about, oh, my meditation is so active, I have so much problem and this and that. You're not smiling enough. Oh, yes, I am. I smile all the time. No, you don't. If you smile all the time, you're not going to have these problems come up. You're taking it personally. You're trying to over-control. And you can't do that. You have to back off.
And some people even find it rather embarrassing to smile all the time because they label it as fake and that's sort of bad.
Well, they don't understand what a true smile is because I have a lot of equanimity in my mind most of the time, but I'm also smiling in my mind most of the time. So, it doesn't have to be here, but it does have to be. Yeah.
I'm telling you, when I'm meditating, and is there any value to actually trying to uncover the links of dependent origination? Like,
you'll start seeing them naturally. You don't have to force it. You'll start seeing them happen. You'll see feeling arise, and then the craving, and then the clinging, and then the habitual tendency, and then the suffering. You'll be able to see that and recognize it as you go deeper in your meditation. It will start to come naturally.
Wanting to investigate that process and that that's a wholesome activity in meditation, is that... Is that something I need to let go of?
You have to be careful with your energy. If you start to get any tension or tightness in your head while you're doing that, back off. That's the key, is with anything. If you have too much tension or you have tightness that starts to happen and your mind starts to do this, you're putting in too much effort, too much energy, and you have to back off until there's balance with it.
So the links of dependent origination will reveal themselves.
Yeah, they do. And that's what insights are all about, because you'll be going along and all of a sudden you'll just notice, oh, that's how that happened. Wow, that's really something. It happened because there was a contact, there was feeling, there was craving. And as soon as the craving happened, I said, start, and the other links didn't arise. Wow, isn't that amazing? That's why I wanted to call this an oh wow meditation. Because there's a lot of oh wows that happen. Yeah?
I have a question. So your instructions were for us to meditate on loving kindness.
To start off with.
Start off with. And I'm finding myself in equanimity, but I didn't see how I got from loving kindness to equanimity.
That's okay. Just stay with equanimity then. And when you're walking, I want you to walk at a normal pace, please. Don't walk slowly. You're walking for exercise. Stay with your object of meditation, whatever that happens to be. The longer you sit, the more you need the exercise. You have to get to going up a hill or running upstairs and downstairs, that sort of thing. Get your heart beating. That's real important. But stay with your object of meditation while you're doing it. Okay? Anybody else?
On what this lady was saying here. Like when you have a hindrance, when I have a hindrance, sometimes, like if I do let go and relax into the hindrance to get back, the insight comes about the hindrance, but not without trying or not without, like, I mean, I'm not thinking
right.
or being psychological, but
right.
it's unraveling.
Yeah.
It just unravels.
Right.
And then that's an insight, and
right.
then I'm back.
Right. That's fine. Anything else? Yeah. Wait a minute.
When trying to think about the spiritual friend, I'm trying to figure out the way to do that, or kind of the way to
help. See them in your mind. See them in your mind.
See
them.
See them.
Now, there's two different kinds of visualization. For some people, the visualization can be seeing them like pictures or seeing them like in a movie. And that's very easy for them. That's one kind of visualization. The other kind of visualization of seeing them is just knowing that that's who you're sending it to. So pick the one that's easiest. The visualization is not near as important as the feeling of loving kindness and the feeling of the wish that you make for your friend. That's much more important than seeing them.
It felt like initially I would see something, but that was a more gross manifestation of that, and then eventually something shifted and it became just like this little homunculus thing in my heart, and that
That's fine.
Felt like that was better, but then I couldn't figure out how to get that back.
Smile more and you'll see.
Yeah.
Just have fun. Have fun doing it. Know the person that you're sending it to, and you sincerely do wish them well. And radiate that feeling to them. Okay? Don't try too hard. That's one of the biggest problems that I have with people that have done meditation before, is they're taught to try too hard. And it's time you got to learn how to back off. So, you had a question.
I think I'm going to repeat Mark's question. So, I'll recognize that I'm having a distraction, but it's fuzzy, but I know
so,
I'm off. So, in order to release it, I sometimes feel like I need to spend more time on knowing what it is. So
no. 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 It doesn't matter what the content is.
Even if it's
I don't care.
So fuzzy's fine.
Fuzzy is fine. Well, eventually, yeah. But stop trying to analyze it. That's a Western disease, and it's a big problem. People can, for years, get caught in that. But when they finally start listening and realize, I mean, last summer, I had a monk come. He stayed for 3 months. The first month he did meditation, it was just great. And then he got it in his mind that I want to be an arahat. So he started wrong effort, and he had a whole month of restlessness. Every time he came, my mind is restless, I'm running all over the place. You're trying too hard. Back off. Don't get involved with it. You're getting involved with the content. Every day for 30 days, I'm saying the same thing to him. then he comes to me and he's really peaceful and calm. And he said, well, I figured out I was trying too hard. So he was my patience teacher. It's amazing. Then you can.
You don't get no respect.
Yeah. It's amazing that I can say something 100 times and then you finally get it and you come to me and you're real excited and you go, yeah, I just found this out. I said, oh, good. Good. Oh, I don't. But there is some relief when they finally. Yeah.
With those more subtle levels of siksari, when suppression comes in, are you to detect that by the way your body's reacting?
It'll cause tense. It'll cause tension to arise in your mind. When you get into the deeper states, you don't have a body. And that's one thing that I fight with the people in Asia because they're very body conscious. You don't have a body, but if there is some contact, you can feel the contact. And you'll say, oh, I've got this real pain in my backside or my back or my knee. And I keep saying, you don't have a body. How can you have a pain there? It's all mental.
So if you are at that subtle level and releasing lots of thoughts, you don't have to worry that it could be suppression. Because...
That's something I have to talk with you personally about because it depends on the situation. Sometimes I'll just tell people if it's not really pulling your attention away from your object, just stay with your object. Just because those thoughts are coming up doesn't mean you have to address everyone. So it's staying on your object of meditation that is the key, even when your mind is object of meditation. Okay? But I'll find out by the questions that I ask, I'll find out what's happening. Now, there are going to be some people that are going to be coming in and they want to sit in on the interviews. If you want a private interview, tell me. But other than that, I want to teach people how to give interviews. So I started doing that, 2 years ago? And it's quite helpful. I don't think it's anything in particular, but everybody else does. So, anything else?
Sure, just one. Going back to when we were talking about precepts and, you know, you're thinking about all the ants under your feet and the bugs on the windshield and the profanity and all the other, you know, stuff that's significant. When and how do you determine whether forgiveness meditation is appropriate? Is there a magic way?
You feel guilty about it?
Hmm?
You feel guilty about it? Then forgive it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the forgiveness meditation, when done in an intensive way, is a very, very, very powerful meditation. It is the most powerful meditation that I teach. You don't have to do it for the whole retreat unless I had one student in Malaysia that when he started out, he was really kind of wacko. And he was taking all kinds of drugs, and he was bipolar, seven or eight bipolar, whatever that means. But he was going through personality shifts that were just unbelievable. And he would follow the directions kind of for a little while, and then he'd start off and do what he wanted to do, so his progress wasn't as fast as it could be. But by the end of the retreat, he'd started to settle down. And when somebody is taking drugs, I don't allow them to stop taking the drugs. And I tell them they have to go see the doctor about that, because they can have shifts back into their old ways of doing things if they get... people like to cold turkey drugs. And you have to do it gradually. You have to do it over 2 or 3 week period, not just stop taking it altogether, because that your body is used to it and you're addicted to it, to be quite honest, and you, then you go through all these changes. But he started following the directions. He came and did a second retreat. By the end of the second retreat, I actually told him he didn't have to do any more forgiveness unless there was something that came up that made his mind tight. And he was starting to do loving kindness meditation and doing quite well with it. So there's a lot of healing in doing the forgiveness meditation, a lot of healing. People that come and they tell me, well, I can't feel any loving kindness. I just don't know what it is. Okay, let's do the forgiveness meditation. Mm-hmm. After 2 or 3 days of doing forgiveness, then all of a sudden they have a breakthrough. And then I switch them over to loving kindness and they just zoom after that. So there was a lot of past old situations that they were attached to. And the way to let go of that attachment is through forgiving. Loving kindness is, forgiveness is part of loving kindness.
When you get students like that, do you find that there's just one or two people that if they forgive, then it's okay?
Well, it depends. It depends on them entirely, but what I have them start doing is forgiving themselves for making mistakes, because we're so hard on ourselves. I mean, we can do just brilliant things all day and do one thing that's questionable in your mind. Then you start criticizing yourself for it. You have to be able to recognize that, release it, relax, smile, and laugh with how dumb your mind can be. But it depends. It's all individual. There's no set formula for anything. And when I have them doing forgiveness, sometimes I have them forgiving themselves for making a mistake, or forgiving themselves for not understanding, or forgiving themselves for causing pain to themselves. Those are real important aspects. Now, there's a real big thing that's happening in this country about, well, you gotta forgive. But people don't know how to forgive. So they just say, well, you did this to me, I forgive you. And then they think they're done. And the attachment is still there. So it still affects them in a negative way. They have to work until they feel relief. How long does that take? How well do they follow directions? But I've had students that have been in a mental institute and I get them to start forgiving and smiling and doing all kinds of things, they leave the mental institute. They don't have to be in there anymore. They don't have to take such heavy drugs. Yeah. And it's, they're doing their own work because they want to change.
And I have a client who is incredibly anxious, and I've tried to get her to do our stuff, but it's very difficult because she has no faith in her ability to control her anxiety. She's also somewhat obsessive as well, so that makes it more difficult for her. Do you have any
come and do a retreat.
Yeah, I keep telling her that.
Yeah. Because it is such a personal thing, you can't just say, well, just do this and that'll work.
Yeah, right.
It depends on what they're going through. And one of the things that the forgiveness does is it helps you to let go of your secrets. Now, one of the definitions of an arahat is a person that has no secrets. Any secret you have that you're keeping and you don't talk about it, that's your attachment. That's your holding on to an old action and taking it personally and causing yourself a lot of suffering. So it is kind of an individual thing. So one of the things that at the last retreat I gave in Kuala Lumpur, I started talking to them about using forgiveness with any kind of physical owie. And you stub your toe, you cut you burn yourself, whatever. Start forgiving right then. And then test on the forgiveness. The next time that happens, don't forgive and see how much longer it takes to heal. Because it's amazing.
What about a sickness bending?
Same?
The same. Or new conditions, whatever, and I'm just like, I have to forgive whatever, I have to forgive that, right?
Right. The more you can forgive little things as you're going along, the easier it becomes to forgive the big things when they come. And the faster you heal. I mean, it's amazing. I have a wood-burning stove at home. And sometimes I get burned. Now, when I start paying attention to that and I start forgiving it, by the next day I don't even have a blister. All I have is a red spot. 2 or 3 days later, it's all gone. Then when I don't, I've got a problem for a week, and I have a blister, and I have a lot of pain. So it's a difference of 2 or 3 days or a week. It's up to me whether I do it or not. So the more you can remember to do the forgiveness with your any kind of owie, whether it's a mental owie or a physical owie, you do the forgiveness, the pain is going to disappear more quickly.
So this is appropriate to intersperse in meditation?
Talk to me about it. It depends where you are. See, it's not a blank... I'm not a one-horse pony or one-trick pony. I have a lot of tricks. So it depends on the situation. But one of the things that it happened a lot when I was in Asia because I was running around barefooted. Barefooted in the forest at night is not a safe thing to do for your toes. It's really not, because you wind up breaking them. And when I break a toe, then I start doing forgiveness every time the pain came up. After 2 or 3 days, I'm not even limping anymore. Or if I don't do it, then I have a couple of weeks of real severe pain. So it's always your choice. What are you doing with your mind when this kind of problem arises? When you make it a big deal and you're identifying with it, you're causing yourself more pain. That's the truth. When you forgive it and you send loving kindness into it, it has a tendency to get less and even disappear. Yeah?
Do you think other Buddhist teachers are aware of these dynamics or not?
Not as much as I am.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, when I first got to Asia and became a monk for a couple of years, I started being the abbot of a monastery. And a lot of people were really suffering very much because in Malaysia, there's three populations in Malaysia. There's Chinese, there's Malay, and there's Indian. And they don't get along very well, and the Malay run the government. So they're always pushing down the Chinese because the Chinese are ambitious people. And the Chinese were walking around with a lot of hatred. So I started teaching them about forgiveness. And I got criticized because the Buddha didn't teach any forgiveness. Well, yeah, actually he did. And it's in the Vinaya, so there's no problem with it. But I was criticized because I was not teaching straight Vipassana. That's the only way to attain Nibbana, you know. That's what they think. But there, in Malaysia, because I started teaching loving kindness more, and I refused to teach straight Vipassana because I'd already gone through the experience and wasn't happy with it, the loving kindness became very popular, and people started changing and starting to really become more prosperous naturally. And prosperous is a word that doesn't necessarily mean anything to do with money or material things. You have more friends when you practice loving kindness meditation. You're more prosperous that way. Things just happen more easily, and that's how you become more prosperous. It's real interesting to see some people that break precepts, how they are continually having one drama after another. And people that keep the precepts, how prosperity and how things are so easy to happen. And you meet the right people at the right time, and you get along with them, and you have fun with them. That's really, it's an amazing thing to watch. So, I thought I was going to get done at an hour and a half, and there it is, 2 hours. So, why don't we share some merit? May suffering ones be suffering free, and the fear struck fearless be. May the grieving shed all grief, and may all beings find relief. May all beings share this merit that we have thus acquired for the acquisition of all kinds of happiness. May beings inhabiting space and earth Devas and Nagas of mighty power share this merit of ours. May they long protect the Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.